Accession number 9476, reel number 4.
Mr. Boone, reel 3. Could you tell me about the water supply, please?
The water supply was obtained daily Crossley tender with a tank, water tank. You used to go to the headquarters or somewhere and obtain water which had been specially treated. Occasionally, if we could manage it, we used the village well water, which we had to boil. But the villagers didn't like us using their supply, their limited supply.
Yes, was there any friction between the villagers and the...
No, there was no friction. You see, we depended upon them and they depend upon us, because these people were very, very poor, and they used to make coffee and they used to sell it to us at the normal sum. But one of the mainstays was doing our washing, and we used to hand our washing to these people, and these old dears used to wash it and iron it, and you go on and hand it in on a Saturday, shall we say, and you go on the Monday and pay them a franc or 2 francs, and you had clean underwear.
So this was one way of keeping clean.
One thing was, it was quite a job to keep yourself clean.
Well, perhaps we can actually move on onto that and tell me what the sanitary arrangements were for you at the chateau.
The sanitary measurements, we had a latrines which consisted of an excavation in the ground, and erected above it was a form of some sort. It was all in the open air. It was very, very primitive indeed, and was pestered with flies. And then the washing facilities. You want to know about the ablutions?
Yes.
We had wash houses, but the principal thing was having a bath. It was essential to have a bath to combat lice, and we were a technical unit, as I say, and the boys used to get the old-fashioned petrol tin, which is square tin, cut them open. Old-fashioned petrol tin was cut open, and you had a sheet of tin, and these were all soldered together in the form of a coffin-shaped bath. And this bath was housed in an outhouse, in which there was a boiler in the charge of the RAMC. And if he paid him a franc, he would fill the bath from the well, and before you got in, he had a cigarette lid into which he put a measure of creosote. This was to deal with the lice. Now, on one occasion, I wasn't satisfied with the one measure of creosote. I put two in, with disastrous results. The backs of my knees, between my fingers, all my privates, in between my toes. I was jumping mad. I got out of the water, I didn't know what to do with myself. It's just a state of the effect of the creosote. But then I can assure you, it never happened again.
What about keeping your clothes clean? You mentioned you could get them washed. Did that effectively reduce the lice or remove them altogether?
Well, you never got rid of lice. I didn't know what the lice was. I'd never seen one in my life. And we acquired some blankets, onesome blankets, from an ambulance van that had been stationed. And these were covered with lice, and we didn't know that. And very soon, we were covered with these things. They were under my arms, crawling about. I just didn't know what these things were. And then I found no lights, so I used to send home for shirts, underclothes, and I used to burn everything. And then we couldn't cope with it. And then we had a technique at night time. We used to invert our trousers and run up the seams with a candle. And you could hear the eggs popping. And you used to keep them under control. And then when you've dressed yourself down and sat, if you had an odd louse on your body, if you kept still, it almost made a one spot between the breastbones. Just wait, just keep quiet, and it would make for there. And you should quietly open your shirt and catch it and press it between your thumbnails. And that's how we managed to cope with things.
How much time would you devote to actually trying to keep clean from lice?
Well, it all depends about the infestation. If you found yourself alive, you used to spend about half an hour or an hour each night trying to deal with these things.
When were the infestations at their worst?
I would say in the summertime they were the worst. Yeah. And you see, we had a set of fellows who had never met these things before, and they just didn't know how to cope with them. And we weren't given any instruction or anything. We just had to find by default.
What about cleaning your bedding? Was there any way you could do that?
No, I haven't any recollection. The blankets being cleaned? No, I never thought of that. I have never any recollection of the blankets being collected and cleaned.
Were there any other pests that were a problem? For example, rats, were they a problem? Rats?
Rats weren't a problem with us. Except when we were in the chateau, we had the granary rats. But in the field, we never had. Not where I was. But I believe in the trenches, they did have a lot of trouble with rats. In fact, the rats became very tame and they found them very friendly.
You said you had granary rats in the chateau. Did they make leaving food around and that sort of thing a problem?
They didn't go. The only thing at night time was they used to nibble at the fellow's feet, that was all. No, they never caused any trouble.
They nibbled at the
soles of the feet. I told you about.
I don't think we have talked about it on tape.
Well, the men used to go sleep in the bunks, perhaps being out at the weekend, and they had consumed an awful lot of beer. And the rats, believe it or not, used to be on the roam, and they used to get on the bunks, and they used to nibble the thick skin off the soles of the feet of the men. And the men would wake up the next day, and they found the hard skin on the soles of the feet gone, and never conscious of anything had happened. That's what you could sometimes you wake up and you see the damn thing still. You'd hardly believe it. After all, there's several people who wouldn't believe me.
Did they make any attempt to get rid of the rats?
No. They were quite the ones smelly. They didn't cause any nuisance, and we had no facility to deal with them anyway. And we hadn't a rat infestation office or anything like that.
Okay.
Now, when these men used to come home after being out on the spree at night, and consumed an awful lot of very, very weak beer, and each in the billet was a large oil drum, which held about 2 or 3 gallons. And they leave this as a latrine. And it used to get very, very full. And it was quite a difficult job, particularly weekends, to get this down the stairs and past the colonel's office without spilling it. And this had to be done in the very early hours of the morning before anybody was about. It was quite a delicate duty.
Was this because it was in fact illegal for them to have...
Well, you see, we were upstairs at the top of a chateau, and you were in your night attire. If you wanted to go to the latrine, just come down 3 floors and walk out in the open in your shirt. Well, it was winter and it was raining, and oh no, we didn't do that.
But were you meant to have done that? Were you meant to have taken that walk if you needed to?
Supposed to. Oh, yeah. the duties were to use the latrines. That was very, very strict indeed, because they didn't want any infection. And I remember at the YMCAs, where the fellas used to be in the YMCA at night, and when they used to come out full of coffee and lemonade and that, and they used to relieve themselves along the side of the hut, and the red caps were there, and they caught anybody doing that, they were up for the gym. And what the red caps used to do, believe it or not, they themselves used to make the motions as if they were doing it. You saw this fella doing it and you followed suit, and he was a red cap. They did, they led us astray by the red caps.
Did you ever get caught yourself?
No, not now. My capacity is much limited. I'm always on the move in those days now.
The conditions you described might have led to some sort of outbreak of ill health. Was that the case? Was there any problems with ill health?
No, I can't remember any problems of ill health. Just where fellows were indiscreet and they went in their towns and got in with touch with foul women.
Oh, well, I was just actually going to come on to the interaction between the English troops and the French. Perhaps we could start there and tell me what actually went on between the English soldiers and the French women.
Well, in the village itself, we got on very well with it. And occasionally we went into the town. And some of the boys used to go to the local Red Lamps. And the man in charge of us, the colonel, our copper, an ex-naval man, and he knew the ways of the world. And he kept a very strict eye on us. And he would not allow anything. We didn't know what a Red Lamp was. And sometimes these men used to disappear. We didn't know where they'd gone to. I mean, this was an atmosphere, a background we'd never experienced. And on one or two occasions, one of the fellows met a foul woman, and he had to be taken to hospital. And when he was taken to hospital, of course, the ambulance were there, we always raided and stole the blankets covered with lice. And this poor fellow was away. And the disadvantage of all this was a most unfair advantage. Throughout the whole of the army, you'd get a man who was in the trenches or in the service for 3 years without a break, and his wife's at home, and then he committed an indiscretion. His wife's pay and subsistence was stopped, and she was destitute. Can you imagine anything more desperate than that?
Is that something you were aware of at the time?
Oh, yes.
Were you given any lectures and talks about it?
None at all. I never received any instructions whatsoever with regard to duties, deportment, the except general appearance. Never received any instructions of any sort, of any kind, at any time.
Mm. Were the Red Lamps official army places, or were they?
No, not to my knowledge. I don't think so. I didn't know much about them, really. And since, of course, I've learned quite a lot about the red areas and the homosexuals, and of course we had to deal with homosexuals as well.
Could you tell me about that?
Well, the word homosexual means something to me now, but I didn't know what it meant then. And we had an interpreter, a French interpreter, and he used to make himself very friendly with the boys, young boys, and he used to try and interfere with them, and they just didn't know what was happening. They never met anybody like that before. And as I said, our corporal was a worldly wise man. He had been in the Navy and he knew what was going on, and we told him what this fellow was up to. He said, oh. He went round all the boys. Heard what they had to say. Without any hesitation, he went and saw the staff captain. And within hours, that fellow was out, back to his unit.
Was he an Englishman, or was he
a French interpreter? Uh-huh. A Frenchman.
Frenchman.
Who could speak English. Yeah.
What, you say people weren't really aware what was going on. What was your reaction later on? I mean, had you had any contact with him at all, that he approached you?
I remember he used to buy sweets, chocolates, which were hard to get. He, being a Frenchman, of course, could we had to go and buy them. And we didn't know what was happening. Just the faintest idea. You see, this sort of thing's commonplace now, but in those days, those things were never heard of. Lesbians and homosexuals and that sort of thing. No, never. Well, you know yourself. It's just these last few years, all these things come to the top.
Do you know if anything was said in the unit following this incident? Was anything discussed? Anything said?
Well, it was a bit of a joke when we found out what had been happening, and nobody was ever interfered with. But you never knew what was going to happen. Of course, I don't know what the developments were going to be.
Well, we started the conversation actually by looking at the relationship between the English soldiers and the French civilians. And you mentioned that the villages, it was a very good atmosphere.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about what was available for the English soldiers in the village?
Well, you see, we're interdependent. And it is in the sense that we were dependent upon what comfort a home or house provided, and they were dependent upon income from what they did for us. These people were exceedingly poor, very, very poor indeed. And they get a franc for doing a little bit of washing, or a half a franc for a cup of coffee. It was quite a lot to them. And it suited us fine, and it suited them, so we got on with the French villagers very well indeed. I had no dealings with the town folk at all, because it was very, very rarely I ever got into a town. Very rarely. The only occasion we got into town is when the tender was going in for rations to the main depot. And he would say to you, there's a space in there, would I like to come? And you used to go, and you would go to the town and you'd buy some postcards and chocolate and anything you could lay your hands on.
If we can just turn for a moment to recreations amongst the men in the chateau, what sort of things would they do?
As I said, there was no external recreation, and we had to keep ourselves busy. And we used to play cards, and dominoes and draughts. I wasn't much good at any of the games. I kept wrong for third man and whist, you know, supposed to play high. Well, I wasn't aware of that, and I used to make a mess of things. I wasn't a good card player or game. I'm never good at any games of any sort, never have been. When I first joined the unit, there were parcels coming in to men whose names had been forwarded to the various organisations long before we arrived, and they were on the mailing list. We weren't on the mailing list, and some of the boys that had been there a long time used to get regular parcels. And one fellow had a very good, his handwriting was perfect, and he had a good flow of English, and he could write a marvellous letter. Then we were issued with goatskin coats, and they were horrible things, and he dressed himself in one of these and sent the photograph. And when the lady who had been conducting his correspondence over all the years received this photograph, she was shattered at what she saw. The parcel was continued. He looked just like a monkey. Yeah, that's a fact. Yeah.
Do you remember writing home yourself?
Oh, I had no correspondence. I arrived too late to be on the mailing list. No, I never received any external parcels. Never.
Really? Throughout your stay in the war?
Pardon? Throughout the stay, yeah. There was a Russian at one time, I remember, a gilt container with cigarettes in. I remember seeing it, but I never received it. I never received anything except my normal ration of cigarettes and tobacco.
Did you not just talking about rations, did you not send any letters home to your parents or receive any letters?
We sent a letter home once per week. We were encouraged to do that, and it was censored. But there was a postcard which was typed, printed, and you crossed out certain items. I am well, I am unwell, and you crossed out what was appropriate. And you were allowed, there was a plentiful supply of those, and you could send as many as you liked. That was to assure the folk at home that all was well. It was a psychological thing.
Did you actually bother writing letters?
I used to write home once per week. And in very veiled terms, of course. And I really used to say that I was keeping well and received the parcel. I was enjoying my food and I had some good friends and I wasn't overworked. I was kept warm and surroundings were reasonable and I had some nice fellas to associate with. And you had to write on that key.
What did you feel about the censorship? Did you know who was censoring your...
The adjutant invariably was the censor. And we knew who he was. And if you said or did anything, I've never come across anybody where they had a letter obliterated or anything. We all worked within circumscribed limits.
Did you receive any leave in the UK?
I was very, very fortunate indeed in the sense that when I was overseas, I received two leaves. And it so happened that your leave was conditioned by when you joined the unit. And it so happened my friend and I, who lived in Newcastle, the conditions that prevailed enabled us to go home at Christmas time. So we spent the first Christmas at home. And the following year, believe it or not, we went on leave at Christmas time.
Could you tell me a little bit about what the reaction of people, or your reception rather, was when you arrived back home from the front?
We arrived back home, of course, all our family, everybody overjoyed to see you. You know, we were safe and well. And I remember very well indeed coming home from leave with my full kit and going down our road. And the clergy were out in the road praying for the men overseas. And here I arrived safely at the door with these people preaching at our door. And of course, it was very joyful to receive because it fitted into their object. And of course my mother was very pleased to see us, and of course the first thing we did when we got home was to go down on the outside buildings and strip off and get all their clothes off on account of the lice. And they knew when you were coming home on an idea, and fresh clothing were waiting for you, and you had a bath and kept you clean. And you see, I belonged to the age group where all the boys of my age were being called up. And the boys of my age, in some peculiar way, used to be on leave at the same time. And I remember being out with boys of my age group, friends of mine. One was in the Navy, one was in the Royal Air Engineers, and one was in the Cadet. And we had a photograph taken of all the four of us with different uniforms on. And we used to go and play football and... I used to go to local Christmas parties and invited all over the place. We used to have a whale of a time, trying to enjoy ourselves. And of course, when your leave was up, tearful departures, and then we used to go again.
What sort of things did you do on your leave? I mean, you mentioned seeing other lads. What
playing football. And visiting houses. Well, we usually been entertained, tea and Christmas games and things like that. And these people, of course, have been saving their rations up, and you were well fed at the expense of somebody being deprived of food. Well, we used to enjoy the leaves very much indeed. And of course, there was a blackout in progress, and then there was the danger of there was the alarm of air raids when I don't know if I mentioned it, but the gas used to go down, and you knew where there was a zeppelin in the vicinity.
Yeah. Were they still taking those raids still taking place at that time?
Oh yes, zeppelin raids were still taking place. I remember the Zepps. I could tell you more. The Zepps. There was an electrical storm, and it threw out all radio signals, and the Zepps were disorientated. They couldn't find their way around. Have you heard about this before? And they were all haywire. They landed and dropped their targets at wrong places. Of course, all the calculations had been interfered with by this electrical storm.
This wouldn't be while you were on leave, though, I take it.
No, it's what happened. No.
I wonder if you formed any opinions about what knowledge the civilian population in this country had about conditions in the front line.
It all depended on but what particular unit there. Relations were in, and if they were in the infantry or in the front line, they were very, very worried all the time. Now, people like my parents, who knew I was in a reasonably safe billet, hadn't that worry. Of course, the seafaring people had that continual worry. My uncle, he was an ordinary sea captain who was made a lieutenant in the Royal Naval Reserve, and he was on minesweeping. And I remember my aunt was always in a state of tension. And my brother-in-law, he was in infantry, and he went over in the Battle of the Somme, and within 3 hours of going over the top, in 3 hours of practically arriving in France, he was wounded and back to England, where he was made an instructor. So my sister lost her worry, but my aunt was always worried about my uncle, and I told my people there was no need to worry about me. I was quite reasonably safe.
Did you have any brothers in the armed services by this stage?
No. I was the eldest male of our family, and my brother, who was slightly younger than I was, he tried to join up in order that he could be with me, but he was too young and it wouldn't happen. My father was an engineer, and he was on marine engineering engines associated with destroyers and that. And my father, I don't know how he was old at the time, I forget now. My father was born in 1857, let's see, what would that make him? I can't remember now. My father was too old to be called up anyway.
How long did your leave last?
The leave normally was about 14 days. That included all travelling. And getting from your headquarters to your point of departure was sometimes very difficult.
Why was that?
Well, you had no transport to take you there, and you had to find your way to the nearest railhead, which you sometimes got to lift with a Russian lorry. And then you would get two men, like my friend and I, in a metal truck, a metal trap about, let's say, 6 to 7 feet wide and about 12 feet long, all metal, metal floor, and here with a lion there with no blankets, nothing, and you've got a day's journey in the winter time.